You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts, Jim and Bobby Bell.
And our opening music was Hot Texas by the Hot Texas Swing Band. We're so delighted that you're with us again this week. We have another really great show. Who's our guest tonight?
Special guest, Vince Pinkerton.
Yes. And here he is. Welcome, Vince.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Hi.
Hey, it's great.
You have a little something?
I have a short bio.
Okay.
Vince Pinkerton is a video producer, writer, and director, currently living in Nashville, Tennessee. Vince is also a self-published author with two books now available to readers. The Devil Plays Six Strings and
right
The Devil
here.
And the Dance. Oh, girl.
Yes, and the Devil, let me get a good shot. The Devil, yeah. And the Dance Hall Girl. Marie's life is a living hell. Oh.
No.
And the Devil, the devil plays six strings, begins in 1930. These are two riveting books. They connect together in many, many different ways. And I will say, as a reader, that I read The Devil and the Dance Hall Girl, and you read the other one. You
Six
read,
Strings, The Devil and Six Strings, yes.
And the opening to this book had me on the edge of my seat from the very first couple of words. And at one point, no spoiler alert, but at one point I was reminded of the tension that I felt as a watcher of the Sergio Leone film Once Upon a Time in the West. There's an opening scene that takes place at a railroad station. And I know, as a viewer, I just got more and more and more anxious. And that's how this book, but I had to keep turning the pages to find out what was going to happen.
I love it. Thank you.
So we're so delighted to have you with us. Vince, did you have a question to get us started?
Yeah, it was a short bio, Vince. Just give us a little more info about yourself, would you please?
Well, I am a lifetime Nashvillean, one of the few left. I've been here since the day I was born, never wanted to leave. I'm actually a television producer here in Nashville. Some people may know is a show called Pearly's Place on the RFD network. That's about our biggest thing. But we've had some different Christian programming that has been syndicated literally around the world, a show called Cheyenne Country. We also run the entertainment television streaming service and just anything else we can get our hands into.
That's good.
So have you always been a writer?
To a point. I wrote a lot in college. Just short story work. There was a small publication I was a part of, and I enjoyed it. But I never thought that would be something that I would try to do on a professional level. It was just something that was fun. And then in television, I've always been on the production side of it. So I did write commercials, short television programming, infomercials, and I'm also a bass player and have been a musician for most of my life and a songwriter on that end. So always writing little stuff. But it wasn't until the idea for Six Strings hit me that I tried to do something of any length.
Yes. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, I'm holding the book up, The Devil Plays Six Strings. Tell us how this book got started in your imagination.
Well, it's a little bit of a long story, But I have a gentleman that I do a lot of work with, and about probably 5 years ago, after a business meeting, we were sitting around having lunch and got to talking about movies, which is something he and I both have a lot in common, our love for movies. And he brought up horror movies and started telling me what he thought made a good horror movie. And he had quite a few things in mind that he thought would make a good horror movie, things that have to happen. And in that conversation, he came up with an idea of what he thought would make a good horror movie. And me being the person I am, I got home and got to thinking about his idea. And I said, well, you know, if the man wants to make a movie, then maybe I should try to write this movie. And I sat down and started trying to write a script based on the ideas he had. And what I came up with was absolutely terrible. I mean, it was just horrible. I couldn't get into it. I couldn't get it to make sense. But that spurred the writing bug in me. I thought, you know, I really want to try this something longer writing wise. So I gave myself a test. Don't know where I came up with the idea, but I decided to sit down and try to write a conversation between two people, one of whom could only speak in Bible verses. And it was conversational. This wasn't going to be a person preaching to another person. This was just going to be a conversation, but all of the answers for the one person had to be in Bible verses. Sit down and did a little bit of research, took a little time, but I did it. I came up with this thing, and I showed it to my wife, and she didn't think it was terrible. I wanted to know what I would do with it. And I said, well, I have no earthly idea. But I had it. And the more I thought about that, I wanted to know why the one man was speaking in Bible verses. Why is he stuck with that? And I just started building the idea around that. And all of a sudden, the man who was speaking in Bible verses, in my head, he had a name. It was Elijah Parker. He was an older black man. He was in the South in that case, in the 50s. And I just kept, I wanted to build on this. I wanted to build on that idea. And that's where the book came from. And if you've read the first book, then that conversation is right in the middle of it. I wrote it that day, it is right in the middle of it. But I just built the story one way and then the other. Actually, I built it from that conversation to what is the end of the book first, and was really into it and thought, okay, this is good, but it's too short. We got to go the other direction. So I started working backwards from there.
Yeah. Are you a student of the Bible? I would think that, you know, coming up with all the scripture, you obviously had to have a lot of it in your head to start with.
I am a lifelong Christian. I've been in church my whole life. To say I'm a student of the Bible, no, sir.
Okay.
No, sir. I'm one of those good Christians that goes to church every Sunday and reads what I have to. you know that. But this was a lot of research. I knew what I needed him to say, and I would go out on the internet and try to research. You know, I would put the question in he was answering. What does the Bible say about this? And you'll find if you're doing that, there's a lot of sites that will give you multiple verses that, you know, we're talking about. Let's say we're talking about fire or something. What does the Bible say about fire? And you'll get a site that may give you 50 verses.
Wow.
And then doing that, I kind of went through and tried to find the verses that fit conversationally. And also, the other thing I did to put that on me is all of his stuff comes out of the King James Version, because that's what a man of his, well, he's an African-American man, but a man of that time, that would have been the Bible they were using.
He was right, yeah.
So, you know, if you want to try to do it out of one of the more modern translations, it's really easy.
Right.
Yes. Go back to the these and the thous, and it gets a little harder.
Well, and it would also be the form of the Bible that would have been passed down through families.
Yes, absolutely.
So unusual, even if you had a more contemporary version. There'd be the older version if it was a part of your family's history or part of your family's legacy. So interesting. What we saw as Jim and I began discussing the stories, there were some things that we noticed that seemed to be in both books. Music certainly plays a role, and you've just shared about a little bit about your music background. How does music? We don't want to do lots of spoiler alerts tonight, listeners. You want to read these books, and even if we say something that we shouldn't have said. Don't let it. There are so many twists and turns and surprises. There isn't any way we're going to give much away tonight. How does music play an important role in these books?
It is. It's an underlying character that runs through both books. You're not going to see. Well, I can't say that. It's an underlying character that runs through both books. In Devil Plays Six Strings, Elijah just has his guitar. It's part of what makes his wife fall in love with him, that he plays, that he sings, and it becomes the way that Mr. Give, who, if you haven't figured out at this point, Mr. Give being the devil, gets him intertwined into a contract. At one point, when Elijah's at its lowest, Mr. Give, the devil, comes up to him and says, "Hey, if you'll just play a little guitar for me, I'll give you everything you've ever asked for. I'll give you, a house. I'll give you a place to raise your baby, food on the table, a little money in your pocket. I'll even give you a woman to help you raise that baby. Just play a little guitar for me." Mm-hmm. So it runs through that it's just part of the threads of the book. I also wanted the title, The Devil Plays Six Strings. That's not just a musical reference. Mm-hmm. I wanted those six strings to represent the different paths that he takes to intermingle, to twine everything together. So it kind of plays in there as well. Mm-hmm. And then when you move into Dance Hall Girl, there's a character named Joe who I fell in love with when I wrote him.
Yeah.
Great guy. And his whole thing is he's trying to get to Nashville to be on the Opry.
Yeah. Yeah. Nashville's Mecca.
To him, it is. To him, it is. Yeah. Absolutely.
I could only get to Nashville. And then you had an interesting observation about walking.
Oh.
Yeah.
I was thinking, I said to Bobby, I said that I'm thinking that some of this took place in Mississippi. And I'm thinking Elijah and Happy's son, they must have walked every single dirt road in the state.
Pretty much.
Back in then, I suppose some of those roads are paved over now. But
well, there's a lot of walking along dirt pathways. Marie does farther in the book of Dance Hall Girls. She walks along dirt roads, and they're often followed by a car on those dirt roads.
they are the walking is on purpose. The walking is on purpose because these books are journeys for both of the characters. Right. they're journeys. And they're hard journeys. And the hardest way to get anywhere in my mind is to walk it. And even like in Dance Hall Girl, there's when the minister is giving her a ride to try to get to where she's going, even then the car breaks down. I mean, and she ends up having to walk. It's definitely purposeful that they walk a lot.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then there's food. Oh my goodness. Marie makes the very finest fried chicken of anybody, but we have wanting food, lack of food, abundance of food. Do you like to eat?
You can only see me from here up. If you saw the down half, you would know I'm a big fan of food. Food is also a love language to a lot of people.
It is.
There's that scene between Mrs. Jones and Marie in Dance Hall Girl, mm-hmm. where Mrs. Jones, who's known for the best fried chicken in the area, makes it for Marie, and then Marie shows her how to make it just a little bit better.
And one of the scenes that I did find myself laughing, which just tells you that these books, there is also humor that runs through, is that wonderful breakfast picnic, Marie and Pastor Mike.
Pastor Mike, yeah.
And he figures, how can I screw up, making coffee over a campfire and fresh fruit? And
he does.
And it's really it's such an endearing scene, and to see Marie actually mirthfully laugh, and both of the characters have a wonderful time, even though the coffee's horrible and the fruit is wax, it doesn't matter, right?
Right. And that is the first time in Dance Hall Girl where you see her let loose, where you see her enjoy her life.
We also picked up on interesting, I'll say, family connections or loss of connections or.
Well, I want to interrupt you on one thing while we were talking about food.
Yes.
You missed one.
Oh.
Both books talk about ham soup.
Oh, yes. They do.
Ham soup with stale bread.
With stale bread.
And honestly, I wrote it and I forget what the French term is. It's like garbon or like that. So that was another one I kind of wove into both of them.
You did, because that was from the shop owner, the little restaurant owner that gave him a bone.
Right.
Of course, when I'm reading this, I'm thinking, is this bone for a dog? Is there any meat on this sucker? You know? But I guess there was.
Just enough for a little soup.
Yeah.
But we were saying too, family connections, loss of family, families mm-hmm. created through other types of relationships. There's just family is woven through both books, yes, we would say.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so. Yeah, it was, it's important in both for different reasons. One, the family line in Six Strings is there so that you understand why Elijah is willing to make the deal he makes.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is for his son. And then mm-hmm. there's a flashback in Six Strings where Elijah is remembering the story his father told him about his grandparents and how his grandfather was killed. Mm-hmm. And that there's just to solidify that family. And that's mm-hmm. also why, again, we don't want to give too much away, but what first brings Elijah to the church, to St. Castellus Church, is such a hard thing for him. Mm-hmm. And then, but in yes. trying, yeah, in, but in doing that, mm-hmm. he gains a family.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it does.
He gains a family. And then that family, love for that family is also why he leaves.
Mm-hmm.
When he sees that particular family. True. So yeah, that's family true. Plays a lot in it. In Dance Hall Girl, family is a different type of story. She mm-hmm. start out with Marie in a happy family, working in a stagecoach depot in the prairie, and something terrible happens, mm-hmm. and she's the only one that walks away from.
Mm-hmm.
But then she discovers and finds a new family in the strangest of places, and that being mm-hmm. a brothel in Animas Forks, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
But yet it's family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is. It's still a family. Mm-hmm. And it's subconsciously, I think it's that drive for family that pushes her through the book. And she sees that mm-hmm. as a possibility with Pastor Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And then she sees that as a possibility with Elijah from Six Strings, because that's where the two books cross.
Right.
You know, so there's always that need and want for family in her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She's a really interesting character. Now, you start Dance Hall Girl, Devil in a Dance Hall Girl, in Wyoming, 1870. Mm-hmm. Was there a reason that you chose Wyoming and you chose that particular year?
Well, I wanted it to be just post-Civil War because I love mm-hmm. Westerns. I love TV Westerns. And the ones I like seem to fall in that period. You know, it's just after the Civil War. Things are trying to get back into shape. You know, I like that period. Wyoming, because even to the day, there's not a whole lot up there. So it's a good desolate place to be if you're outside the big cities. Yeah. And I think I mentioned to you when we were talking earlier, there was a TV show named, and I'm gonna forget it now that I'm sitting here.
I think it's Laramie. Was it Laramie?
Laramie, mm-hmm. that is set in a stagecoach depot. And that was kind of where I just all those things going together. I wanted it to mm-hmm. be a cohesive, happy family in the middle of nowhere, because what happens needs to be in a completely desolate place. Mm-hmm. And then thinking about Laramie, I thought, oh, hey, it's Coach Depot. That would be kind of a neat thing to do. So,
yeah.
You know, we got a lot of characters we could talk about, but we're talking right now in Laramie in the beginning of the Dance Hall book. You know, you introduce a character so despicable. So despicable. Where'd that cowboy come from?
Out of my nightmares. He's rough. He is rough. And he shows up just for a minute in the first book, but then he's a pretty huge part of the second. And when I was having that, it was an interesting conversation. When I finished the second book and it was in the hands of my editor, she always works with me. I tend to try to cross point of view and inside of sections. And there was a section I wrote. It was something that the cowboy did just awful. And she sent me back a note saying, you should write this from the cowboy's point of view. And I had to tell her the cowboy has no point of view. Uh-huh. The cowboy is a walking embodiment of evil.
Right.
He doesn't think. Everything's instinctual. So I can't say the cowboy thought or, you know, the cowboy looked and saw this and that's why. Because there is none of that. Because he has to be the absolute embodiment of evil.
Mm-hmm. I wondered, we kind of were talking about them as a triad. We have Mr. Give. We have the cowboy, and we have Apollyon.
Yeah.
And the three of them work pretty closely together. And I couldn't help but think, you know, I guess, Vince, the more I read, there were times that I actually put the book aside to just think through. There's a scene when Mr. Give, who we've identified as the devil, he kind of says to Elijah, is it Elijah? He says, I can take your career away and it'll be like it never happened. And no, nobody
to happy.
And nobody will remember you. Nobody will, you know, it'll just disappear. And I actually put the book down for a moment and I thought, now if he really makes that happen, what about all of those people that had jobs where Happy performed? What about all the people that met and fell in love at the concerts that he performed in? You know, like if his whole career disappears, even though he's still here, he's still a man, you know, he's still living, he's still here, but it disappears, then how many lives are impacted by that decision to just, it's just smoke and mirrors. And then I thought, oh my gosh, how many people do I cross on the street that have contracts with the devil that I don't?
Yeah. And it's a good point. It makes you wonder sometimes. I've known a few that I thought maybe had. Another thing I try to do in these books, and throw this out there, I've had some people refer to these as Christian literature. They are and they're not. Mm-hmm. I tell people, I am a writer who's a Christian. I'm not a Christian writer. Mm-hmm. And there are two distinct differences in the two. Mm-hmm. So these books have a Christian storyline through them, because if you're dealing with the devil, that's kind of where you got to be. Yeah. But in doing that, I also tried to make a subtle point that a lot of the things that Mr. Give does and stands for can be looked at as the same thing that sin does in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So that point where he has that conversation with Happy. Happy has become very famous. He's become larger than life. He's enjoying it. Let's put it that way. And how many musicians do we know that have had enjoyed the sinful nature, the drugs, the alcohol, the women, and have destroyed them to where they don't have a career anymore? Mm-hmm. And so there's that. It's a little subtle run in there, but that's kind of where some of that comes from as well.
Yeah, and I get that. I think as we understand that this is another thread. Once we really identify who Mr. Give is and that he is a liar, that was also I know that about the devil, but. Again, many times I just sat and I just sort of thought about that, because I thought about it from the writer, like as the writer, knowing that this character is a liar, then was that fun to write him? And was it fun to let your mind kind of go like, okay, I can write this scene, but he's a liar. So this scene doesn't really happen.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's definitely fun. Yeah. It's fun to look at a situation where I know something needs to happen. I know something, well, usually, and it's something bad. Something bad is going to happen, but it comes at the hand of Mr. Give. So I have to make sure Mr. Give presents it as a positive, not a negative, knowing full well I'm going to promise, as Mr. Give is going to promise somebody something great in order for something bad to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, mm-hmm. it's a fun little twist. It works your brain a little bit to work through it.
First, all our characters think he's telling the truth.
Well, so of course. Well, yes, they think
makes
he's telling
the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's not omnipotent. He can't. He really only knows what they say to him.
Yes,
then that's a major. That's kind of a major difference between, say, he and God, is that he can only go by what.
Right, right. He, the way I play it is, if you have a deal with him, as Marie makes her deal, mm-hmm. then he can get in her head.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's points where she tries to hide mm-hmm. some things and he still finds out about it. But as in general, mm-hmm. as the world in mm-hmm. general, no, you know, that's why he has these people working for him. He's trying to force things to happen, but he can still be surprised.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He doesn't like to be surprised.
No.
Yeah, no. Yeah, I actually asked a question about a minor character, but he's important in a time piece in the book. Very mm-hmm. important. And that's his father. That's Elijah's father-in-law, Jesse.
Yes.
I picture this guy about 9 foot tall, you know, about 3 foot wide. He is a big guy.
Yes, sir.
And he would scare any potential suitor away, I would think, without any problem.
And I think he probably is glad he can do that. Yeah, Jesse is that strong father yeah. figure, yeah. Physically as well as emotionally. A strong father figure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think yeah. he becomes an influence on Elijah.
Yes, he does. You know?
And then I think that again feeds into that family, the idea
mm-hmm.
of family in the books.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Elijah at one point compares him to his own father and grandfather in that same flashback scene. It reminds mm-hmm. him, seeing Jesse's love for his family and protection of his family reminds yeah. him of what his family was like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to take a look at a place that we have that where many of the books can be found of the guests of Rendezvous with a Writer. Let's hear a little bit about Out West Shop's bookshop on bookshop.org. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer with special guest Vince Pinkerton.
And I have a special announcement. I'm just going to take a moment. We have a friend, author Bill Wilbur. Short Stories Wanted. This could be you, Vince. Bill is planning a series of anthologies about Old West outlaws, and he invites all writers to submit stories they feel would fit. He is seeking specifically at the moment submissions of traditional Western short stories about Billy the Kid. Billy remains one of the most polarizing figures of the American West. Was he a Robin Hood, or was he a killer? Was he a romantic? What's the truth of Billy the Kid? Perhaps he was something in between. Stories should be no longer than 5,000 words, and deadline for submission is August 1st this year, 2023. And when I get off the show tonight, I will post a link to Bill's information on our Rendezvous with a Writer Out West Facebook page. But this could be really fun, and we're hoping that Bill will get a lot of submissions. He's a great author, and we're excited for this opportunity. So check out our Facebook page later this evening, and we're back with Vince.
All right,
we're back.
We're back.
Did you have any other characters we want to talk about before we
so
ask
we,
the process question?
We have a few characters that you get killed off.
Yes.
And is that difficult as a writer? How do you decide And how do you decide how to have it happen?
Well, how is a different thing. How is just a product of my strange thinking. it bothers me how well I can come up with ways to kill people sometimes. But it is tough. And because you live with these characters. You live with these characters for a long time where you're writing these books. They become part mm-hmm. of you. So, yeah, it's very hard to kill them off. So I try to make the deaths of any major characters be for a very good reason. They need to propel mm-hmm. the story. It's not just, you know, violence for the sake of, ooh, let's write something gross. Mm-hmm. You know, their deaths need to mean something. Mm-hmm. That's kind of my realm on it. Now, there's a few minor characters that maybe get killed off just so I can go, oh, that was cool and gross. But yeah, but the major ones, I tell you, one of my favorite samples of that, and I won't say too much about it, but in Devil Plays Six Strings, there's a comedian that has to go on stage when Elijah is late. Right. I had a lot of fun with him.
Well, yeah. No, go ahead. Because I know that you know exactly that, because you told me about that scene.
Yeah, I remember that scene. These are all different sort of characters, all different in their own right. But as you wrote, did any of them actually surprise you in what they did?
Yes, especially in Dance Hall Girl with the character of Joe. I knew what I needed Joe to do. I knew where I needed him to go. But when the devil shows up and makes his deal, tries to make a deal yeah. with Joe, that came out of the blue as I was typing.
Okay.
So yeah, that surprised me, the way he dealt with it. And we won't say much more than that, but the way he deals with with an attempt to get him to sign over to the devil, that came as a surprise to me. Mm-hmm. There's another minor character, mm-hmm. and he's so minor I'm going to forget his name at this point, but he's the blacksmith in the little town that Marie's cafe
in Skullbone. Uh-huh. Yeah, the blacksmith.
His character up one side and down the other was a surprise. Mm-hmm. He surprised me when he stood up and started singing with Joe. Mm-hmm. And from there I loved him. So I knew I had to do something. But he's another like Serafina's father. Yeah. He's another big, huge human being. And when he encounters what we later find out was the devil getting in there, the fact that he packed up and run.
Yeah.
That caught me a surprise too.
Yeah. Do you, as an author, there are some, you know, characters that are shared between books, but you also have some minor characters. Do you kind of keep track of the names of your characters and, you know, whether they're still alive at the end of that book, or, you know, do you forget and you bring a character back that, you know?
I do forget. unlike a lot of authors, I don't outline. I have no plan for these books when I start writing. I start writing and I let the story take me where it goes. So because of that, I don't have a lot to look back on. Mm-hmm. So I spend a lot of time when I'm writing, scrolling back up to figure out where something happened or when it happened or who it happened to, and can I use them again down here? Mm-hmm. Or does this reference make sense to something that happened before? Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's a lot. I also like certain names I'm discovering, and I'll use the same name for two characters and then I have to go back and think of another name. But that's just me and my scatterbrain way of thinking.
Yeah. Go ahead.
There's
a scene with Marie. I think she's with Apollyon, and he shows her a version of, I guess I'll say hell. I don't think he calls it that, but he shows her what would happen, you know, if she doesn't comply.
He refers to it as the welcoming committee.
There you go. And I remember years and years and years ago reading Dante's Inferno, and it's not really Dante's Inferno, but it's that same, you take us on this flight with her. And we feel what she's feeling, which is terrifying. You know, it's like, where did that vision of that place come to you? How did that come to you?
Again, out of nightmares. I sat and I tried to think what would be the most frightening thing if I were to be dropped into hell. Mm-hmm. What would scare me most? Mm-hmm. And I tried to put that into words. And I hope I got there.
Yeah, you did.
And I tried to, there's pain involved too. That's not burning. We'll leave it at that. She has a tour guide, I guess we could call it, in the big animal. Mm-hmm. But that is part of an ongoing thing in that book as well. For Marie to do what Mr. Give needs her to do, she has to be torn down. And that's what happens in her childhood, what happens to her parents, then what happens at the brothel. Those are there to kill her will, to just tear her down so that when he makes his presentation, she's happy to jump at it.
Yeah.
And that visit to hell is in a book, in a part of the book where she's becoming self-confident again. She's arguing more. She's fighting for position. And he has to tear her down.
Yeah, it's a gripping scene. I know you have at least one or two more questions that you want to ask.
We're talking about these horrific scenes and what goes on. How do you stay detached from these things? I mean, do you get into them too much and think, oh, my goodness, I got to go take a break?
There's a few times I walk away. I just step back and sometimes it's because I'm too deep into it. Sometimes it's because I'm afraid I've gone too far and I need to step back and rethink it. Part of what keeps me from do that is the way I write. I don't sit down at 10 o'clock in the morning and write till 5.
Okay.
I run a business. I run a production company. So writing is my escape from real life. It is my creative outlet when sometimes my job is not as creative as I would like it to be. You would think television production is always creative.
Right.
Yeah. Sometimes it's, so a lot of times I'll be working on a project on this screen of the computer and I'll have my book open over here. And when I need a minute from the job, I'll go write. And so there are days that I sit down and just write. I'm trying to find a day to do that now to finish the third book. But a lot of time it's bouncing back and forth. So that keeps me from getting too deep into my own head, I guess.
What do you hope readers will take away from these books?
I hope they just have fun with them. I try to make them fun. I'm not really trying to teach any great life lessons here. I hope they have fun with them. I hope it's an escape. Anybody that's read scary fiction, I'm a huge Stephen King fan. You don't go to a Stephen King book to learn a life lesson. You go there because you want to be transported into some really weird place and experience something completely different. And that's kind of what I do with this.
Thank you.
You decided to self-publish. Had you done any research with, publishing houses, or did you just decide I'm ready to go?
I was at the point of looking at publishing houses. I have a dear friend who lives next door to us named Sue Buchanan. I hope she won't mind me calling out her name. Sue is a very well-known writer in her circles. A few years back, she does more consulting now, but I get her to read everything. After my wife, it goes to Sue because I trust her just completely. And I was talking to her about publishing, and she pointed out that my books are probably a little, or at least these two are a little too Christian for a secular publisher, because I do let that section work. But at the same time, they're probably too Christian for a secular publisher.
That's interesting.
So I'm in a weird space between the two. And she also said that it had been in her experience, at least in the last 10 or 15 years, that publishers aren't like what they used to be.
That's true.
Used to be, if you got a book published, they promoted it. They did all this, that, and the other thing for you. Nowadays, getting, at least from what she's been told, and I've had this followed up with a couple of other authors I've talked to, publishers at this point in time more or less just put their stamp on your book and then tell you to go out and promote it yourself and then take 40% of anything you make.
That's all right.
You know, so with that in mind, I just went the self-publishing route. Now, you know, if a publisher out there is seeing this and gets really interested and calls me and wants to discuss it, I would, right, because it's hard. I mean, it literally, it is hard to get books out of your circle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think you have a big circle of people around you, and you realize really quick that that circle is not near as big as you think it is.
Yeah.
So, you know, luckily I have, you know, friends like Jennifer Heron, who has got me in touch with y'all, that helps me get out of that circle and get a little farther out. So, you know, that's been a blessing. But yeah, I mean, that was the main reason I self-published, was just I was told, and I believe that it probably would have been very difficult to get these published, not because of how they're written or the quality of the stories, but just because of the subject matter itself.
Right. We're going to take one more quick break.
Yeah.
One more quick break, and we're going to be right back. Here's a word from our sponsor, OutWestShop.com.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. Special guest, Vince Pinkerton.
We've been talking about his two books, The Devil Plays Six Strings and The Devil and the Dance Hall Girl. So, Vince, where can people find these books?
Right now, the easiest place is Amazon. They're available. I self-published through Amazon, so they're available on Amazon. They're also on Kindle and Kindle Unlimited. If people would like, I'll throw this out there too, if people would like a autographed copy, a signed copy, they can reach me directly through the email devilplays6strings@gmail.com. They can send me an email and say, hey, I would love to get an autographed copy, and I will shoot them a PayPal link and then get it in the mail to them. Also want to mention, y'all been kind enough to show those. They are also available in hardcover.
Oh,
great.
Boy, these cameras are weird. There we go.
Yeah.
So they're also available in hardcover for people who like a little bit sturdier books.
Sure.
Yeah, great.
And you don't want just one. You will want them both, because the story is so connected. I would say
they run adjacent to each other.
Yeah, adjacent to each other. Yes, exactly. Do you ever get writer's block?
I haven't hit one of those where I walk around for a month not able to figure something out. I get them momentarily. I get them for a day, you know, where I'll be in the middle of something and just cannot for the life of me figure out how to get out of it. But I've found that if I step away and just think about something else, that it'll come back to me and it'll tell me how it needs to work out.
Do
you have tips for new writers, other writers?
Just write. Sit down and do it. That's if you sit down and think about it, man, can I write? Should I write? How will it be? Then you'll talk yourself out of it. Just sit down and start.
Like
I say, this all started because I was trying to write a script and it was terrible. And if I had just said, well, forget it, I'm not a writer, you know, but just do it. That's the biggest thing. People say to write what you know, and I think that's part of it too. I've told this story before, and I'll bring it up here just because it meant a lot to me. When I finished Devil Plays Six Strings, which is about a black sharecropper in 1930 in southern Mississippi trying to raise a son in the midst of you know, terrible racism and things such as that. Well, you're looking at me. What do I know about that? You know? So I kind of pulled on some memories, things I had seen when I was younger of how white folks like me, how I saw people treating African-American people. And I also produce a TV show called Dr. Bobby Jones Presents for the Impact Network. And Dr. Jones is a superstar in black gospel music. That's all you can say. Over 50 years on television, bringing gospel music, bringing specifically black gospel for the most part to television. He was 35 years on the BET network. Now he's on Impact Network. And in the 10 years that I've worked with him, I've heard some things, you know, A lot of times I'm the only white guy in the room, and they know me and they love me and they talk freely. These, you know, his people talk around me, the people he worked with, let me put it that way. I don't want it to sound like I'm saying anything else. The people he works with, they're free to talk around me. And I've heard some terrible things. And a lot of that is what led to me being able to write that part of that book. But at the same time, when I finished the book, my wife read it and she said, you know, I think it's good, but you do realize you're a 57-year-old white guy. Are you sure you want to put out this book about, you know, the trials and tribulations of African-American people in the 30s? And I thought, you know, you're right. What, you know, should I even be writing this? Am I whitewashing it? You know, what do I do? So I took the book to Dr. Jones. And I said, you know, he's in his early 80s. He lived through this period for the most part. So I took the book to him and I gave it to him. And I said, Doc, I just want you to read this. I didn't say anything else. I said, I've been playing around with writing a book. Just read it and let me know what you think. No pretense to it. A couple of weeks later, I was at his house doing some work. And he said, I read your book. And I said, oh, what'd you think about it? And he said, oh, it was good. And I thought, well, that's exactly what you want to tell somebody when you didn't like what they did. You know, you're not going to say anything bad, but you're just going, oh, it was good, you know, and then walk away and do something else. And I said, okay, so I've got my answer. You know, I don't know if I've offended him, but he didn't want to talk about it. So we just went about our business. And a couple hours later, when we're done, I'm leaving. And he's a very gracious man. He walks me out to his porch every time I leave. I'm just about to get in my truck. And he said, let me ask you something. And I said, what, Doc? I thought he was talking about the edit we were doing. I said, what, Doc? He said, how did you do it? And I said, do what? He said, how did you get it right? And I went, okay. And that
there you go.
Yeah, that led to about a 30-minute conversation. But I left there saying, okay, you know, I feel good about doing this. And I've never told him, but if he had not said that, if there had been no more discussion, I would have, that book would have sat on a shelf and I would have been done.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness.
Mm-hmm. You know, so
this has been so wonderful chatting with you, Vince. Once again, we're talking with Vince Pinkerton and the two books, the first, The Devil Plays Six Strings, and the book that runs alongside of it is The Devil and the Dance Hall Girl. And we're just so appreciate that you gave us your time tonight.
Oh, I love being here. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. We're going to just take a moment and don't go away. We're just going to kind of wrap the show. We're looking at the time on that clock. So let's see. Jim, next week, our guest is Teddy Jones. And she is the author of Marva Cope. And we're looking forward to chatting with her. And let's see. We want to also thank Alex Dormont and the Hot Texas Swing Band. And you have a couple of quotes, as always.
Yes,
what have you got for us tonight?
From the book, The Devil Plays Six Strings, spoken by the character Happy. My pappy had a verse he used to quote all the time. He'd say, watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation, for the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. And from The Devil and the Dance Hall Girl, spoken by the character Joe. He was a murderer from the beginning and abode not in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he speaketh a lie, he speaketh of his own, for he is a liar and the father of it.
Oh, my goodness. I can't wait for book three. Thank you so much for being with us tonight. And thank you once again, Vince Pinkerton, for being our special guest. And let's see. What's our final comment?
It says, remember, it's always a great day out west.
See you next week.
You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.